I insisted that the Presidential Decision Directive on Terrorism, issued in 1995, address the possibility of terrorists getting their hands on chemical, biological, or nuclear materials. In 1996, however, only the Department of Defense was taking the chem-bio threat seriously, and the Pentagon's concern seemed limited to the safety of their troops from such weapons. No one took responsibility for the safety of all the other Americans who might be hit with chemical or biological or even nuclear weapons. Sandy Berger had moved up from deputy to become the National Security Advisor in 1997. I wanted him to have the president insert funds for the program into what was, after all, called the president's budget request to Congress. Berger advised against it. If the departments don't want the money, they'll just go round our backs to the Congress and tell them to shift the money back to the department's own pet rocks. It was a disappointingly realistic assessment of White House power. What you have to do, Dick, is scare the shit out of the cabinet members, the way you've scared me with this stuff. Make them want to do something about it. Make it their idea. That seemed like an invitation. You assemble them, I'll scare them, I responded. They assembled in the oddly prim and proper Blair House, a series of connected townhouses opposite the executive office building on Pennsylvania Avenue. Attendance was mandatory. Berger had told everyone that the president wanted them there, but he had never said that the president would join them. When they showed up, Berger made me the chairman of the meeting. It was to be a tabletop exercise, a simulation of a cabinet meeting during which certain events would unfold. We began with a report on the big screen of a spreading infection in the Southwest. It could be a natural outbreak, which sometimes happens in New Mexico, what one scientist called the land of the flea and the home of the plague. Then another report. The infected patients were diagnosed with Marburg, or Ebola, which was incurable and contagious. I walked over to Secretary Donna Shalala of Health and Human Services and asked, "This would seem to be your problem. What are you going to do? Will you quarantine the area? Do you have that authority? Who goes in to help?" While those questions hung in the air, I moved in front of Attorney General Reno. I asked her, "Let's say for the sake of argument that we can quarantine the area. How can we stop people who want to leave the quarantine zone? Do you order them to be shot if they resist?" No cabinet member knew the answer. While they had their views, which differed, it was clear there was no plan. The second scenario described a chemical weapon released in a U.S. city. The group dealt better with that, but still realized that most cities had neither the training nor the equipment to deal with such an event. The third scenario hit closer to home, literally. In that scenario, a terrorist group called the FBI and announced it had a nuclear weapon in Washington. At the end of the day, a collection of black Cadillacs fanned out from Blair House, carrying appropriately frightened senior officials back to their offices. In a few weeks, it was time for more, this time with the president attending in the White House cabinet room. When the cabinet members arrived, they found their usual places at the table taken by strangers. The strangers at the table had been assembled at my request by Admiral Frank Young, who had just retired from the Public Health Service. They included a Nobel Prize-winning biochemist, several other scientists and researchers on antidotes for biological weapons, and the New York City Emergency Services Director. Together, they had drafted a budget proposal for an aggressive plan for responding to a biological weapons attack. They briefed the president. Their plan would do in 1 year what I hoped to fund over 5 years. Clinton looked over to the OMB officials attending. "I think we really have to do this stuff. Let's see if we can find the money."